You're listening to Free Radio Olympia, 98.5 FM. I'm here with said friend, who just took a trip to Venezuela. And can you tell us what that was like?
Well, for the first couple of days, we traveled around Barquisimeto, which is, I think, northwest of Caracas. And we visited a bunch of co-ops and farms and visited with coordinators of some of the social programs that Chavez has implemented. And then we went down to the World Social Forum and just kind of went nuts from there. The group split up and we all just kind of did our own thing. And there were like thousands of events each day. So it was really kind of chaotic trying to get from one place to another. And it was a little bit insane, but I think overall a pretty amazing experience.
What would you consider a highlight of the forum?
Of the forum?
Uh-huh.
For me, the highlight of the forum was I went to see Greg Wilpert, the founder of Venezuela Analysis, speak, and he did a presentation on the psychological and cultural obstacles to post-capitalism in Venezuela, and incorporated developmental psychology into his presentation as contributing factors to the obstacles, and it was just really interesting, and he's a really good speaker, and so I think that was probably the best event that I went to.
And maybe people might not be familiar with the World Social Forum. Can you tell us like a little bit of history about it?
The first World Social Forum, I'm not exactly sure what year it was. I think it was 2001, and it was in response to the World Economic Forum in Switzerland, where all of the economic bigwigs go and kind of make decisions for everybody else. And so the World Social Forum was just a response to that and getting as many people involved as possible to kind of, I guess, dismantle the top-down decision-making structure that was going on at the World Economic Forum.
So what other events did you see at the forum?
I went to an event about the free trade agreement of the Andes and learned about resistance to that.
Is that like a U.S.-backed trade?
Yeah,
thing?
Yeah. It's basically like another NAFTA or CAFTA with, I guess, Ecuador, Bolivia, Colombia, and
Peru, maybe?
And Peru. And so there were several speakers at that event just talking about the effects of the FTA or what the effects would be if it was implemented and resistance to it, and like both in Latin America and in the States, and people really trying to lobby around Congress in resistance to it, because, you know, both the U.S. Congress and congressional bodies in those countries have to agree upon it. So they're just talking about different tactics that they would use to oppose the FTA.
What were some examples of the tactics that they used?
Well, there were a lot in Latin America. There were a lot of direct actions like road blockades and stuff like that. But they seemed to be focused on just really bringing it to the government and, you know, not just staging protests, but that's definitely a part of it, but bringing it to the attention of the decision makers in this case. So, and really trying to put pressure on Congress people.
And what has the results been from that?
Well, the FTA, I think the final decision is not until sometime next fall, I think. And so it's kind of, I wouldn't say up in the air, but they're sort of beginning that process right now of trying to mobilize people in opposition to it, especially in the States, to try and get the government here to say no to the FTA, which would be pretty amazing. So,
well, So, what is the significance of the World Social Forum being in Venezuela this year?
Well, as you probably know, Venezuela is kind of a hot spot for, I guess, progressive politics right now, just with all of the advances that Hugo Chavez has made in Venezuela, not only rhetorically, but pragmatically, actually taking steps forward and upholding his promises in terms of social programs and doing things to help the poor and rejecting U.S. imperialism and stuff like that. And so I think it's kind of the perfect place to hold the forum this year, because not only is all of that stuff going on, but there's really a focus on participatory democracy in Venezuela. That's kind of one of Chavez's tenets, is really trying to get people involved in decision making. And so I think it was a pretty ideal place for the forum, both ideologically and practically, because there's just a lot going on right now. So
what would you say that participatory democracy looks like in Venezuela? Like, how is that being played out?
Well, we actually went to a cultural center in the town of Sinari, I think it was. And we went down there, a delegate from the ministry, the government ministry there, he was there telling the people at the cultural center about what was going on in the country and what the government was doing. So it's his job to go to all these different towns and like educate people on what's going on, which is something that I've never seen, I think, here or anywhere else. But so there's that, and like they took a survey and had people write in comments like what they thought was working, what they thought wasn't working, what they wanted to see. And we also went to various community centers where people had, like, it was just an amazing coalition of all of these different groups coming together. There was a computer center, a radio station, a TV station, a clinic, like a dentist's office, a co-op, all in this community center that was funded by Chavez, the Chavez administration. And so that, I think, is really important for participatory democracy, because it allows people to come together as a community and make decisions and decide what they want to do with the money that they're getting from the government and what steps they want to take forward. And it was pretty amazing. And they also have they're called, like, we went to this thing called a nucleus for endogenous development, which basically just means, like, endogenous means from within. So just these centers that are autonomous in the sense that they get to decide what they want to do with these funds, this coming from the oil company, this one in particular. And so they had a textile co-op, a free clinic, a shoe store, a shoe factory, and just all of these different things, and really getting to decide how they wanted to make progress in the country.
So basically the central government is giving, like, startup capital to small cooperatives to autonomously make goods in their own communities?
Pretty much, yeah. There was the big textile co-op that we saw, and then there are also smaller co-ops like blanket making, hammock making, where it's just kind of out in the sticks, where it's just like a barn sort of thing with a bunch of looms in it, and a few owners who are also the employees selling their goods. And the government also, not only for co-ops, but for things like housing developments, they'll give really flexible loans to people to start up housing developments, where they have really long time to pay it off with like a 1 or 2% interest rate on it. And basically the only stipulations of that kind of the housing development agreement is that a group of people has to come together and make a proposal which is another aspect of the participatory democracy that's going on there, is that there are a lot of provisions requiring, like, a certain amount of people to be on board with something, like...
Like how many, for example?
I'm not exactly sure, but I know for the urban land reform that he's been implementing, you can't claim the title to your house unless you get approval from a number of other people in the neighborhood. I think it's actually a pretty high number. I would have to check, but it's really, you really have to get like approval from those that are living around you to do that kind of thing.
So that, how would you say that would like contrast to, say, corporate welfare in the United States, or, you know, land development in the United States, where you don't have to ask the neighbors around, you know, before you clear cut or whatever you do, you know?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's, yeah, basically the opposite of that, which I think is really interesting. I mean, I think that there's definitely some positive aspects of it, just in terms of like getting community together and making sure that people aren't infringing on each other. But then at the same time, I think that there are certain excesses, like having, I feel like the number of people that you have to consult to claim the title on your house is a little bit excessive, but I would have to kind of go back and check on that. But I just remember thinking it was a little bit high, but, I think it's definitely just not like forcing people to come together, but really encouraging people to come together, I think, is an important role for the government to play, because it certainly, the government here doesn't play that role at all.
So how does the media fit into that?
Well, the media there, or the media here?
The media in Venezuela.
Well, the media in Venezuela is 95% private. And there's only one national state-run TV station. And I really didn't get to watch a lot of TV while I was there. We didn't really have any free time, but pretty much everything that I've read about the media there is that it's just completely manipulated created a completely distorted image of Chavez himself, and also manipulated events and I think steps that the government has taken, and really done a lot to pit the poor against the rich, the poor who are supporting Chavez and the rich who are opposed to him. It does a lot to just kind of draw this line in the sand between the two. And, I don't know. I mean, a few of the people that I talked to there who identified with the opposition, actually, I had some really interesting conversations with them, because first of all, they were young, maybe, I wouldn't even say middle class, because they were telling me that there kind of isn't a middle class anymore. It's sort of just like either you're poor or you're rich. But they definitely weren't the wealthy white landowner business types that the opposition is portrayed as. And they were just basically, it seemed like they had gotten a good dose of that manipulated media from what they were telling me about just events surrounding the coup and the social programs and stuff like that. So I think that the media there has done everything that they can to discredit him. And it's pretty amazing that with all the clout that the media and the media owners have, that he's still the president.
So it's not exactly like all poor people love Chavez and all rich people hate him.
No, I wouldn't say that. Even though there's an obvious sort of, not separation, but, you know, the programs that he's implementing are helping poor people. And I also think that the wealthy sort of business types, especially those who own the media, which are just sort of a handful of people, and, you know, there's a family, oligopoly and all sorts of stuff like that. I think that they're not used to having a government that's not in their back pocket or is not catering to their wants and needs. So there's definitely a conflict there, but it's not black and white at all. And I think a lot of the young people that we spent time with down there, who are mostly students at the University of Caracas, were not Chavez supporters, but didn't really want to say anything.
Yeah.
Because the group that we were with was very pro-Chavez, and we're, you know, and it sort of dawned on me after a while that all of the student translators that we were with had been completely silent about the issue. And whenever we asked them what they thought about Chavez, they sort of changed the subject or just were kind of afraid to talk about it. So,
why is that, do you think?
Well, I think a lot of it was probably just social pressure, like being with a group of, you know, progressive students from the United States who, you know, were not Chavistas, but seemed to be really enthusiastic about the Bolivarian Revolution and all of the programs that Chavez has been putting forth. I think that they maybe would have felt a little bit uncomfortable, but I think they were also sort of instructed to, quote-unquote, let us experience it for ourselves and make our own decisions, which I thought was a little bit silly because all of the events that we were going to were highlighting the positive results of the Bolivarian Revolution. We weren't really seeing any negative results or, you know, we weren't getting a lot of critical analysis. It was just sort of like, oh, this is great, this is wonderful, et cetera, et cetera. So I think that they should have been allowed to put in their two cents so that we could have gotten a more diverse picture of what's going on there and what people think.
What critiques of Chavez did you hear while you were down there?
I heard quite a few people just that were critical of how the social programs, especially the educational missions, were being facilitated. We met with a female coordinator of Mission Rebus, which is a high school education program, who was really, really enthusiastic about her work and was really glad that she's doing it and that it was happening, but had some definite qualms with the Chavez administration, which she didn't really specify, but she told us that the participants in the mission were not learning from teachers. They were learning from videotapes.
Well.
And not to say that that's, you know, completely hopeless, but it's definitely, I think, a little bit inadequate. And a couple of other people that I talked to said that they went and visited these missions and they just walked in and there was just these students sitting, staring at this videotape and nobody was explaining to them what was going on or explaining the relevance of what they were learning, and that they just didn't really have enough time to absorb all of the information because it's, you know, it's a high school education program, but it's not 4 years long. So I think that one of the critiques is just not enough time and energy being put into making sure that people are learning what they need to learn.
Why are there not enough teachers?
I don't know. but the woman who was the Rebus coordinator, when we asked her how she became involved, she said that they just called her up on the phone and asked her to do it. So I think that, I think that's some sort of an indication of a little bit of lack of organization or ability to get people on board with that kind of thing. I know that somebody who, one of the students at the university in Caracas, was telling me that a lot of his teachers and a lot of teachers at private institutions were really anti-Chavez, and just maybe they felt like their positions were being threatened or that they were going to sort of get recruited to do these missions somewhat involuntarily, sort of the way that Cuban doctors are, you know, they're sent on missions to other countries, and otherwise they're not really allowed to leave. So I think they might have been a little bit I don't know, just skeptical or unwilling, but I'm really not sure how that works, how they assign people to facilitate these missions. So
has Chavez's government like affected the curriculum at the university? People complaining about that?
I'm not really sure. We didn't get to see any of the missions firsthand. We were supposed to see one, but the event sort of got canceled. But I'm really not sure of the specifics of the curricula there.
I read somewhere that Chavez has made like great advancements in literacy.
Mm-hmm.
Does that have to do with the video teachers or... What's that like? What kind of programs is it like?
That the literacy programs are is called Mission Robinson, and from what I've heard and from what I've read, it has yielded some really positive, widespread results. And like, I don't remember what the number was, but I think over 1 million people, at least, have been taught to read in the past couple of years. And I think that it's volunteer run, where like educated people are just either recruited or volunteer to teach people how to read. So it's definitely like they don't have, I don't think they have staff, but they just sort of have people helping out. I don't think that that particular mission is video centered.
So you also went to the countryside, right? And mm-hmm. toured around. Can you tell us about that?
Well, it was amazing. It was just really, really beautiful. And
so like tropical jungle?
It wasn't so much tropical jungles. It was just mountain ranges, lots and lots of green, really amazing skylines. But really the experience in the countryside, I think, highlighted the sense of community more than anything else, because even though we saw that in the city, it wasn't the same, because the people that we visited with up in the countryside were just like, everybody knows everybody and they spend the whole day together and they just like spend really quality time together. When we went up to Sonari, when we arrived, they were like this group in this community was, they were having like a Saint Antonio celebration when we came, and it was just like, it was just really amazing to see that, because I never see groups of people here or in most places in the States just like getting together in the middle of the day to either celebrate something or just to hang out. And we saw lots of people just hanging out on the street corner talking, like hanging out in the middle of the day, and it just seems like we don't really have time to do that, or we just don't do that. But yeah, I just think that the experience in the countryside really highlighted the warm social atmosphere there.
And what do people mostly do in the countryside? Like, what kind of crops do they grow and stuff like that? Mm-hmm. Like, what is the, you know, community kind of structure look like?
Mm-hmm. Well, the places that we went weren't, like, we didn't go to very many farms or places that people were actually planting. We did go to one family's home that they had a greenhouse that they built with government funds, and they were growing like tomatoes, onions, cabbage. But I'm not very familiar with the agriculture there, but I do know that that is also, that's another area that Chavez is trying to improve upon, is developing more agriculture, so that Venezuela is not so dependent on imports from other countries, because I think they import something like 70% of their goods from other countries because they're so dependent on oil, like exporting oil. So we didn't really get to talk a lot about agriculture or see very many people working around that. We just kind of went to that one place and talked to the people who are growing there and selling their goods and selling their seeds to other producers. So
what's the oil industry like? Like, how does that affect the economy in Venezuela?
Well, The oil industry there is nationalized and has been for, I think it was nationalized in the early 80s. And Chavez actually, early on in his first term, I think, he changed the administration of the oil company, much to the dismay of of a lot of opposition members. And there was actually, I think some of the marches were in direct response to that change in the oil company. So it's definitely a very heated subject there. And it does, you know, they are very dependent on exporting oil because the oil boom in the 70s moved everybody from the country into the city. And so it's difficult for them to go back to other economic structures. But a lot of the social programs are funded with oil money. And Chavez is using his power in oil to sort of at least try, I think, to distance himself from trade with the United States and focus on Latin American integration and having trade pacts within Latin America that don't involve outside, like, really powerful countries like the U.S. or Europe. And, you know, he and Argentina have a pipeline agreement, and he also has a pipeline agreement with Bolivia, and he's really using his position as sort of the oil man of Latin America to build these ties, and I think also diversify the economy in Venezuela, because I don't think that he wants to just to have that sort of mono structure. And I think he's simultaneously trying to build agriculture and relationships with other countries in Latin America to sort of shift away from this capitalist monopoly that's very tied to the United States. So
what about these pipelines? Like, what do environmentalists in Venezuela think about these pipelines and dependence on oil?
We didn't really get to speak with any environmentalists, but there were some people who were reporting back from the World Social Forum that were very concerned about the pipeline, especially the one going to Argentina, because it's so long. And it's gonna, you know, their concerns are that people are gonna get displaced, and that it's gonna cause a lot of ecological damage wherever it goes. And they're upset with him for not addressing those concerns or even, you know, having a public debate about it, because you would think that with such an emphasis on participatory democracy that the people would be included in such a major decision. But I know that's definitely a focus of some criticism.
Yeah, I bet so.
Yeah.
Wow. So what do people in Venezuela, you're with a group from the United States, and what is people's main reaction to people from the United States coming to the World Social Forum and, you know, taking tours?
I think we got a little bit of a distorted picture of what it might be like for a foreigner there, just because most of the people that we were with were expecting us, and it was their job to show us around and sort of, you know, be very accommodating. So obviously we spent a lot of time with some really, really friendly, really amazing people who we got to be very chummy with. And then when we were in Caracas, away from the group, we had, you know, sort of split up and were allowed to go off on our own, I think that we also might have gotten a little bit of a distorted picture, because there were so many foreigners in one place.
Yeah.
And a lot of Americans in one place. But I didn't experience any hostility from anyone except for maybe one instance of someone being slightly unfriendly. Like, it really wasn't, we didn't really experience any anti-American sentiment. But Caracas is a dangerous place, though. It's not, you know, we definitely had to watch out a little bit, and especially if we're going to go out at night, go in a big group. And actually, another really interesting occurrence there is that while we were there, two people within a week jumped in front of subway trains and killed themselves, like, during the forum. And at first we all thought it was politically motivated, and we were kind of like really, we were really freaked out about it. And then we were talking to a bunch of the students there, and they were like, oh, that happens like once a month. So,
why is that?
I don't know, but it was really, really disturbing while we were there. But, and then the way that, like, we were all really shocked. And then the people that we were talking to were like, yeah, I hate it when that happens. Like, I'm trying to go somewhere and somebody jumps in front of the train and ruins my day, or like stops traffic, you know, and they always go at rush hour. And so I just thought that was really interesting. Like, the response to that. And it may be just be because it happens all the time and people are just sort of accustomed to it, but it was really bizarre.
Sounds like it.
Yeah.
Can you tell us, like, you know, like, Bush and Chavez kind of changed or exchanged jabs all the time, and I'm wondering, like, how, like, that's what I was meaning, like, about the whole anti-American mm-hmm. sentiment. Is it more like, I mean, people are like, how could you vote for Bush? He's this maniac running your country, you know?
Yeah, I didn't actually have that many conversations with people about Bush, but a couple of people asked me what I thought about him. And I, you know, told them that I was not a fan. And they sort of, you know, they had a couple of comments to toss out there, but it wasn't like a big thing, but there were a lot of banners and posters, like anti-Bush banners and posters up, especially really enormous ones hanging from hotels and stuff like that, which, you know, for the forum, but not just for the forum. I think that it's probably somewhat common. But we didn't really run into a lot of that while we were there, but they're definitely, I think even those who are, like, not all of them, obviously, but a lot of the people who are anti-Chavez are just as anti-Bush. But definitely not all of them, so.
Wow. So, what kind of preparation did you do before the trip? Like, books that you read, maybe?
Well, I read The Venezuela Reader, but I didn't get to read it before the trip, and I sort of ended up reading it during the trip and after the trip, which was actually kind of cool because I got to read about all of the things that I saw and learned firsthand while I was in Venezuela, like all of the missions and stuff about the oil company. So while I was reading the book, I was like, oh yeah, I remember when so-and-so was talking about this. But it's actually a really good book, and I think it does well to outline just Chavez's presidency thus far, U.S. involvement in Venezuela, and just basically what's been going on since 1999.
Cool. Any other books? Anything people should read, know about?
There's another book called Venezuelan Politics in the Chavez Era, Class Polarization and Conflict, I think. Which I haven't read, but have heard good things about. And then I believe there's also one called The Battle for Venezuela, but I'm not sure who the author is, but the editor of The Venezuela Reader is Olivia Burlingame Goombrie. And I would highly recommend this book.
Does that go into the coup and all that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, extensively.
What were people's comments about the coup that lasted a couple of days, I guess?
Mm-hmm. That was sort of another thing that we didn't speak in depth about. There were countless references to it and people talking about, oh, I remember, you know, when the coup was happening in the media and yada, yada, yada. But we didn't have too many in-depth conversations with people about it. But we did, we watched a documentary about the day, the days of the coup. It was actually narrated by our tour guide. And we watched it on the bus from Barquisimeto to Caracas. I think it's called Puente Yaguno, Keys to a Massacre, or The Keys to a Massacre. And from what I hear, it's pretty similar to, well, somewhat similar to The Revolution Will Not Be Televised, just sort of uncovering the truths around the April 11th, 2002 coup, like what really happened and how the media manipulated images and stuff like that. So that was, I think, probably the most that we, like, studied. Like, you know, that was the biggest chance we had to focus on that while we were there, because we were kind of, I don't know, I think that maybe they didn't want us to dwell on that aspect of what's been going on there. They wanted us, they really wanted us, they wanted to focus on the missions and the positive things that were going on
what's
there.
What's going on, yeah. Really? As opposed to, like, spies
and
Pat Robertson assassination comments.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Right on. Do you have anything else you'd like to talk about that we might not have touched on yet?
Let's see.
Got a notebook full of
notes. Yeah, I do. It's insane. I guess, yeah, I mean, I guess something that has really sparked my interest is, media involvement in Venezuela and in the events going on in Venezuela, as well as, the U.S. media's response to it or censorship thereof. And, it's something that I've been thinking about a lot, not just the practical effects of it, like just how the media has really manipulated, like created a distorted image of Chavez and manipulated the events surrounding the coup and all sorts of things, but how the media is the right wing or mainstream media and then the left wing or alternative or indie media is sort of having this battle that's above and beyond what's actually going on in Venezuela, and sort of another kind of polarization right there that I think is really detrimental to the public who wants to know what's going on and, you know, is hard pressed to find accurate information. You have the mainstream media that is largely anti-Chavez. Definitely in Venezuela, the mainstream media is completely owned by the opposition. And then here as well, it's, you know, unfriendly to say the least. And then there's, and then there's this sort of knee-jerk reporting going on where indie media, like not all indie media, obviously, there's a lot of good stuff out there about Venezuela. There's Venezuela Analysis, and lots of other really good websites and newsletters. But I feel like there's this tendency to backlash against mainstream media who has demonized Chavez and the Bolivarian Revolution with the sort of like, oh yeah, well, he's doing all of these great things. Look at this and this and this. And because they're reacting so strongly to all of this criticism, they fail to be critical as well, which I think is really necessary. If you wanna truthfully analyze something, you have to be critical and not just completely cheerleader about it.
Yeah.
So that's something that's really interesting to me, is that it's a sort of lack of responsibility on both sides of the issue.
What do you think could change that, if anything?
I think it's just, it depends, it's dependent on reporters and journalists who, you know, have to make an effort to really take a step back and digest the entire situation without resorting to ideologies or just rhetoric, and who really need to. I think the best way to support what's going on in Venezuela is to be critical as well as supportive, because you can't improve upon something if you're just resigned to it. I think it's really important for people to just remain skeptical and then portray that in their writing so that other people can get an accurate picture of what's going on.
Cool. Well, thanks, said friend. Do you have anything else you'd like to add?
If you go to Venezuela, don't eat cheese for about a week before you go. Because you're going to be eating nothing but cheese while you're there.
What kind of cheese?
I don't know, but it's a mystery. It's a mystery, very pungent cheese that will, could kick your ass.
Yeah.
So just be careful. And avoid dairy as much as possible before you go.
Right on. Well, thanks for the advice.
You're welcome.